This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Intuit, the technology platform that brings financial confidence with products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. You might have learned the recorder in school, but probably not how to navigate the financial world. Luckily, Intuit's on a mission to help with the free Intuit for Education program. It provides students with the lessons to learn essential skills, like how to build credit, file taxes, and budget. Check out their free resources at intuit.com/education.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Hey, it's Steve Balton. Welcome back to My Turning Point, where this week I have an incredible episode with you. I sat down with the legendary Carlos Santana to talk about his new documentary, Carlos. Fascinating conversation that touches on so many great subjects in music history, including the time Jimi Hendrix complimented him. So hope you enjoy this one as much as I did.
Are you in Vegas? Has your residency started already?
We're starting
next month.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, so do you spend a lot of time there in Vegas?
It's valid between here and Kauai. We have a home in Kauai and San Francisco.
Yeah, no, I know the last time we talked to you, we're in Kauai. So I remember that. So, man, it's such a fascinating thing. Look, you and I have talked so many times over the years, right? And I was going to say, it's very interesting because I look at it this way. When you do a song, when you do a cover, you get into the spirit of the song and you get to hear it. When someone covers your song, right, you get to hear their interpretation of it. So a documentary is a very big interpretation someone has of your life. So when you watched Carlos, even though I know you were very hands-on with it, were there things that surprised you in the way that, because again, you're living your life. You're not sitting there reflecting on all this stuff.
It's still my voice. Everything from beginning, middle, and end is still my voice. I'm the one that's narrating it. I'm the one that's breaking it down. That's one of the things that I ask for me to have beginning, middle, and end say so, how I'm being presented. So it's still my voice. So nobody was interpreting me. I was presenting me, who I am, have been, and will be.
Interesting, but obviously the director still had to have a say in the footage and you know, again, they put it together and then you decide what works and you tell the story. But so even from the way it's like, you know, when you're making a record, right? And you and I have talked so much about collaboration. You may know exactly what it is you want, but the musicians are going to bring their own feel and then you see it all put together. So I kind of meant like that.
It's all my consciousness, and by finding this person, Rudy Valdez, there was no conflict. It was all with harmony and oneness, and we were in the same page, same book, same paragraph. So I feel very, very confident and very assured that when people walk away watching this documentary, that it's my heart. It's not somebody else interpreting it for me.
So for you, it's interesting though, because again, going back to the idea that, you know, you're busy living your life. You're not thinking about all these things. So were there some memories, some things in there that were kind of jogged for you that were interesting to think about? Or of course, again, you know, even looking back on your upbringing in like Tijuana or your relationship with your dad and the music, that's probably not stuff you spend a lot of time thinking about until it's a film. So were there things that were particularly interesting for you to revisit or that were particularly meaningful?
Yeah, all of the above. For me, it was funny. It was really funny. What I learned from my mom and what I learned from my dad, how it intertwines like a peppermint stick, red and white. It's just conviction and confidence and charisma and magnetism. My dad had a magnetism like Clark Gable, you know? I mean, women really, really like, oh, don't go say this, don't say that, you know? And I was like, damn, you know, I want some of that, you know? It was very, very charismatic person. So that's what I wanted from my dad, the charisma, and I got from my mom, conviction. I feel really, really grateful that I was born into this family, and because of them, I was able to attract Bill Graham and Clive Davis, and they opened up ginormous doors for me. So my whole life has been nothing but, you know, I felt like a 7-year-old kid who crossed the border, and there was somebody waiting for me with a whole bunch of roll of tickets for all the rides and all the food in Disneyland, you know? Because everybody who I met went out of their way to treat me with respect. And for the most part, B.B. King and Tito Puente and Miles Davis and Johnny Hooker, I mean, they really went out of their way to adopt me and encourage me. You know, the few ones who are like, were negative to me, they try to put me down, you know, I'm not lying, they're all dead. They're all died, you know, and not because I did anything, but I didn't take it personal. I was like, oh, I wonder why that person felt like that about me, you know? And then I realized it had nothing to do with me. It's their own insecurity or their own whatever baggage or luggage they're carrying. But in any case, they're not here no more. You know, they don't bother me. They didn't bother me then, they don't bother me now.
Well, see, that must be something that's so cool. When you do a project like this, it allows you to give thanks and to reflect on all those people who were there for you, but to really also acknowledge, you know, because you and I have done that in interviews over the years, but for you, I'm sure as you go through this, you really get to think of those relationships. And it also, I imagine, allows you to spend a lot of time thinking about what you learned from all of these great people. So were there lessons that you hadn't thought about in a while, but you start looking at all of this and you see, okay, Bill Graham taught me this, Miles taught me this. Were there things that really stood out to you?
Yes, Miles taught me that always bring counter motion. If anybody goes up and down, which means pizzicato, you know, staccato, you go left to right, bring legato. You know, when you take a solo, and people are like, whoa. It's kind of like opening the doors and windows and you let fresh air come in. From Bill Graham, what I learned was that you have to have a balance also, because Bill Graham says if you want to see the Grateful Dead, you got to see Miles Davis. And if you want to see Santana, you got to see Roland Kirk. So his institution was very balanced with sharing with the hippies multidimensional consciousness and approaches to, you know, Buddy Rich and 10 years after, you know. Same thing with Tito Puente. So everyone taught me how to develop a big Rolodex and a big portfolio. Santana's not a one-trick pony.
So for you, it's interesting. When you do a documentary like this now, what is it that you hope young musicians take from your experience? Because now you're in the role of getting to teach the lessons that all of these great people taught you.
I hope that all of them come in, look at what's happening, and they walk away with a deep sense of self-worth. You know, for me, I got my self-worth by going on stage with Otis Rush and Buddy Guy and B.B. King. And even though they're from Chicago and they're known to be headhunters, you know, and that's who they are, you know, somehow I was able to hold my own, and they respected me. So I want people to have a deep sense of self-worth, not arrogance, but conviction, you know, because I think that's what's missing a lot in the youth today. This is why people shoplift. This is why people do mean things. You know, they have a lack of self-worth. When you have a deep sense of self-worth, you don't do unsavory things. You don't do mean things. You don't do harmful things, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because obviously social media plays a big part in that, and there's such as competition and stuff, but it's very interesting for you from a music standpoint. You know, when you think back to discovering your sort of voice and you know, how that ties in with stuff. Talk about how discovering your musical voice tied in with your sort of finding your self-worth, because I think when anybody finds their calling, like for me, it was writing, and you figure out what that is, it does empower you so much.
Thank you for saying that. All my life, since I was a kid, people said, the way you play a melody is heartfelt. And the way a lot of people play a lot of notes, but you play themes. You play specifically a certain way, a melody. You know, so what I learned from my dad and from my mom, that a melody, if you know how to play it correctly, it's like a sincere, heartfelt hug, and you don't smell bad. You know, when you get that hug, smell really good, you're like, you know. Not that many musicians can just play a straight up melody. You know, for some people, it's very, very challenging and very difficult.
Do you remember when you first discovered that you could play a melody?
Yes. I was in Tijuana, and my dad kept entering me into this contest, radio contest and fair contest. I would play in a fair or a radio contest. And I kept playing Fascination. With my violin. And I kept winning. You know, I would just win. And there were like 50 people, 50 different people. And all of a sudden, they gave me the trophy. Or they gave me the ticket to this, you know. And so I gained a lot of confidence that what I was playing was resonating with people. Young people, old people, black, whites, all kinds of people. And so that gave me confidence that I was able to convince people that what I'm playing is like bringing water to the desert.
Yeah. It's so interesting for you, though, because it's funny, because I'm a big believer, and I've had this conversation. I've been working on this project with my writing partner, Sage, who was so bummed to miss this interview, because I have told her what a magical person you are, and how every time we talk, you're like one of the few people I can think of. When you walk into a room, you're glowing. It's always such a wonderful experience. But it's interesting, we talk so much about the unconscious and how that factors in. And for you, you know, do you feel like you've had that experience where the music comes, the melody comes, and everyone has talked to us about the fact, whether it's Willie Nelson or A$AP Rocky, that it comes from a place where you don't even know where it comes from. And do you remember the first time you had that experience?
Yes, in Tijuana, being next to my father. I remember somebody saying, well, that gentleman is really good, but his son is like something else. And I was, you know, I'm like, and I'm right next to my dad, you know, if you accumulate certain, it's like putting beads on a string, you know. One of the things that really gave me a lot of confidence is when I was with Jimi Hendrix, and the first time I met him, he went out of his way to shake my hand, and he said, I love your choice of notes. And he says, Santana, right? I says, yes. He goes, grabs my hand, and he goes, I love your choice of notes. Now I'm like, damn, you know, I inwardly go, damn, you know. So when Miles Davis says to me, I'm playing Concerto de Aranjuez, and he goes, you know how to do it right. A lot of people don't know how to play it right, you know? So when I get a compliment from Miles Davis and Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix and B.B. King, it must be pretty good. You know, after a while, you just accept that you are the real deal, you know?
And but it's interesting you say that, because you've also, like you said, you've always done it with self-worth, but never arrogance. So for you, do you credit that to your upbringing, to the idea that, again, because when Jimi Hendrix comes up to you, and it's funny because, you know, we just lost Robbie Robertson last week, and I had a very similar experience with him. I interviewed him when I was like 24, and I remember putting the phone away, like pulling the phone away from my ear and being like, what the fuck am I doing talking to Robbie Robertson? I was so nervous because I felt so unworthy. And at the end, he's like, you ask great questions. And it's that moment where you, when people you respect tell you it, you do feel like you can do it. But it's interesting for you. How did you make sure that that never translated into arrogance?
Arrogance is insecurity. And I'm not insecure. Never have been. I don't have a victim mentality. My mother said with clarity, you are who you are because of God, and you have what you have because of people. Be grateful to both. People bought the CD, the cassette, the A-track, and so because of them, you have this car and this house and even that guitar. So be grateful to people because they bought your music, and be grateful to God because he made you. You know, I helped, but he made you. And so when I look at it like that, you know, it just makes me feel like I am really, really blessed to cross the border, come to America, and somebody hands me like two rolls of tickets to go to all the rides and all the food that I can eat at Disneyland. You know, somehow meeting Bill Graham and Jerry Garcia and Michael Bloomfield, you know, and they're all looking at me like I'm bringing something to the table, like, you know, like I'm some kind of darling kid, you know, and I'm first in the beginning, I used to feel uncomfortable because I wasn't used to getting adulation and so much attention. You know, I was like, ooh, you know, like give it to somebody else. And I think, you know, that's because like most people, I didn't have a deep sense of self-worth. Now, when I say deep sense of self-worth, it doesn't mean you're arrogant. It means that you have a knowing that you're priceless and you're precious because God loves you and he believes in you.
Interesting. Well, unfortunately, I mean, we could, as always, we can talk all day. We don't have a lot of time. I'm curious, though, one of the things that's cool about a project like this as well is it allows you to go back and revisit some of the music. Because again, most artists never go back and revisit their music. They're always thinking about the next thing. So for you, were there any songs that you particularly appreciated watching them in the context of this documentary? Because of course, again, like we talked about, when you do something like this, it triggers so many memories.
The memories for me are really funny. Like for example, and I love telling the story because Bill Graham, you know, he introduced me to Evil Ways, Willie Bobo song. He introduced me to She's Not There. And so Bill was always turning me on to songs that he felt that I should do. And there was one particular song that he said, you got to do the song. I said, well, what song is that? He goes, it goes like this. And I'm like, oh, shit. So I grab my guitar and go, he goes, not like that, schmuck. Aren't you listening? And I said, Bill, show me the cassette. Play the cassette. So when they play the cassette, it's, which is like a hymn, Yiddish, Jewish song from way back, you know? So when I started playing it, he goes, like that, schmuck, how come you didn't play that at the beginning? I just because you were saying, you know, and he could only hit one note, but in his mind, he was hearing the whole melody, you know? So it was hilarious for me that the way he just like, not like that, schmuck. You know, are you listening? I'm like, oh, shit. You know, Bill, do me a favor, man. Play me the song. Once I learned the song the way it was in the cassette, he goes, like that. It was in his book. He said he played that song all night one time. He was with his lover, this lady. He says, man, I just played that song over and over. I love the way you played it. So, you know, to me, it's like that with honoring, you know, Bill and Clyde. You know, when someone like Clyde Davis says to me, come here, and I go, I get close and he goes, come here, I want to tell you something. He goes, I want you to know that with you, in Whitney, Houston, with you is my heart. With everybody else is a job. And I was like, thank you. Know? So when Bill Graham and Glad Davis give you that, you know, it makes you feel grateful and humble that you can be accepted at that level with them, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, from a writing standpoint, do you remember, because again, I want to come back to the unconscious thing for a second. Is there one moment for you where, is there one song that you remember that really stands out where it came from a place where, you know, again, you had that sort of connection with the universe where it just was there? Because again, I could talk with everyone from like Stevie Nicks, who will tell you about hearing songs in dreams, to, you know, Dolly Parton, who will tell you, like, or Smokey Robinson told me a great story about Tracks of My Tears, how he literally was working on it for a month. And then one morning while shaving, it just came to him, like, you know, well, what if it's like it wiped your, like, if it's like, you know, what if it was like the tracks of your tears on your face, you know? And so oftentimes it comes from this like place where when you just open the antennas, it comes out there. Do you have one of those stories that really stands out for you?
Yes, it was Samba Pati. And it was interesting that Eric Clapton says to me, Carlos, let me ask you about Samba Pati. I go, okay, what is it? He goes, where were you inwardly? How did you get a song like that? And I said, you know, Eric, we just got to New York from Europe. We did our first tour in Europe and we got to New York and I had a serious jet lag. You know, I mean, I didn't know what time it was. I was like numb, serious jet lag. And I was in my room in the 12th floor. I opened the window to let some air in and I heard in the alley someone playing the saxophone, and it was a wino kind of derelict playing saxophone. And he was like, you know, it was bobbing and weaving, but he was really drunk. And then I saw that he couldn't make up his mind what to put in his mouth, the bottle that he had in his back pocket and drank it, or the saxophone, you know. And I was like, oh shit, is that going to happen to me? You know? So I immediately heard the lyrics. Through every step in life, you find freedom from within. Through every step in life, you find freedom from within. So I heard the poet first, or the lyrics first, which, you know, and then I heard a melody. When we were in the studio recording it for Abraxas, and I played it in one take, my headphones were like this. But when I finished, you know, they were like, the heads were in my nose and the back of my neck. Because I was bobbing and weaving. And when I finished, everybody was like, dang. And I go, how was that? And they go, wow, man. Wait till you hear it. They go, you're going to have a hard time playing it live because, you know, because it came from that unknown place, you know. But for me, it was like a badge of honor when Eric Clapton wanted to know, how did you write a song like that? You know, and I said, it's a place that I learned from Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock. They call it the unknown and unpredictability.
You know, what's fascinating about that, and I know we got to wrap up in a minute, but it's funny because I've talked about that. And I actually just spoke about this with Herbie within the last 2 months. But every artist will tell you, like, I talked with Robbie Krieger about writing Light My Fire. Steve Wynn would give me some love, and they'll all tell you, if they're like, if we knew how to do it, we would write that song a million times. So it's so funny. The unknown, because it is unknown, and unpredictability, you can never know when it's there. So have there been moments where you've been able to access it knowingly, or is it just something that just you have to just open your mind, and if you get lucky, it hits you?
At this point, luck has nothing to do with it. One of the last conversations that I had with Wayne Shorter, he said to me, Carlos, Miles and I, we talk about it a lot. And we don't call it jazz. We have never called our music jazz. We call it, I dare you. I was like, ooh. He says, when we take a solo, we think of I dare you, which means play like you don't know how to play. When Miles said that to, I think it was John McLaughlin who said, play like you don't know how to play. You know, he grabbed the guitar, he grabbed the neck, and he says, don't play like that. Play like you don't know how to play. John McLaughlin told me the story. And Eric Clapton wanted to know, hey, Carlos, when Miles did that to Eric Clapton, I mean, when Miles did that to John McLaughlin, what did you think? I go, well, he wouldn't say that to me. He goes, why not? I says, I already play like I don't know how to play, you know? And, but see, what I'm trying to say is this. What Miles wants is the purity in the innocence. Children don't know what they're doing. And that's the purity and innocence. So when they play, you're like, they captivate your heart, you know? Opposed to somebody who practices it over and over and over and over and over, like a typewriter after what, and they play the music, there's no juice, it's dry, you know? So that's what Miles said, don't play like that. Don't give me the stuff that you practice over and over. Play like you don't know how to play. He means give me the purity and the innocence. That's what he meant.
That's fascinating. When you do a documentary like this and you look at your childhood and you look at the upbringing, does it show you how you're able? Because unfortunately, for a lot of people, they just don't know how to tap into that purity and innocence.
I was really blessed that I followed my light, my spirit, and my soul. And they took me to John McLaughlin at the United Nations Center, across the street from United Nations Center. There was a church there, and then there was a guru named Sri Chinmoy, and he taught me the art of real meditation. When you meditate, you enter into a place that you're out of your mind, and that's the best place to be. When you're out of your mind, you're shaking hands with absoluteness and totality, you know? Yeah. The mind tends to overanalyze everything, you know, and dissect it and fault finding, you know. But when you learn to meditate, there's a certain room you enter where it has nothing to do with logic or knowledge. It's a different kind of light wisdom that a child can understand. This is why I love John Coltrane, because Coltrane can play the universe and the galaxies, but even a child can understand it. You know, and to me, Coltrane is el número uno, you know, when it comes to, like, you know, the king of improvisation.
So how does the music and the meditation tie in for you?
How does what?
The music and the meditation, when you look at it, how do they tie in for you? How does the meditation influence the music?
I utilize my imagination to go into a place where I can go into the Pacific Ocean or a swimming pool. And when I get into a swimming pool, you know, I'm floating. And once I'm floating, the universe takes over, and you start hearing the songs. You start hearing profound purpose. I love that people are going to see this documentary, because people can learn to do what I've been doing. I have the capacity to access, like when you media up, you know, that's exactly it. You media up your phone to the grand computer. When you media up your heart to God through a meditation, that's when you become, I guess I want to say it, you become a spiritual badass. You know?
Yeah. Well, I know we got to wrap up. Is there anything that you want to add I didn't ask you about? Because that is a great wrap-up note, as always.
No, I'm fine. I'm okay with badass, a spiritual badass.
Dude, it's always such a great pleasure to speak to you. Yeah, so you have the residency coming up and the film comes out in the...
I'm very, very grateful. And the best is still ahead, because now that I don't know what I'm doing, it's more fun. This is my mantra now, you know, be happy and have fun. Be happy and have fun. Listen to Nina Simone, Etta James, Tina Turner, Aretha, and Miami Jackson. and then grab your guitar and grab all of that, like creating carrot juice, and then you drink it and you play, and people gonna know that when yeah. you play, you bring multidimensional spirit with you.
I love the fact though too, actually, I know we said we were wrapping up, but it's interesting that you put together those artists. Now it's funny for you, because I love the fact they're all female artists. It's interesting. I'm very curious. Are there artists that you've been excited about lately, or do you still get into music discovery? Like, do you still find artists that really excite you?
Yes, Derek Trucks, Oriente, Quinn Sullivan, and all the youngsters. But I mainly go back to Wayne Shorter and Herbie right now. They're the newest. Everything they play is like a child that is new.
Okay. No, it's funny for me, because I think having done this so long, I still really get excited by music discovery. Like when I find a new artist that excites me, that's like, to me, like the coolest feeling. And I love the fact though, too, lately it's been more female artists. I love the fact that for you, when you mentioned all those artists you put together, that it was all female artists.
Well, I learned the attitude from them, how they walk, how they move their neck. You know, women have an incredible sense of conviction, you know. I don't listen to that many men other than Marvin Gaye and Coltrane and Miles. But even Miles, he doesn't sound like a male. He sounds like a female. Coltrane sounds like a male, you know?
Yeah.
Thank you, man. Appreciate
Always
it.
Always a pleasure, dude. Thank you so much.
Take care. Stay precious. Bye.
Hey, it's Steve Balton. You've been here on My Turning Point with special guest Carlos Santana. Thanks.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.